I've wanted to teach a biblical survey course for some time, and even before the transitions took place, one of the things that we were talking about doing was having me teach a biblical survey course on Sunday evening. So we've referred to Sunday evening as our equipping hour, our time for equipping and in terms of a time of more teaching, and we'll actually be doing a number of different things on Sunday night. But one of the things that we'll be doing, Lord willing, is teaching a Bible survey course, and I'm going to be doing that one Sunday night a month. And so if you want to follow along in your Bible, you know, follow along reading the book of the Bible we'll be talking about, it will actually be very easy for you to do that because you'll only have to read one book a month instead of doing it every week, and that might get, for some of the longer books, difficult. But surely you can read a book of the Bible in a month to keep up along with what we'll be doing. I love getting into the details, like in our 1 John series, where I'm taking just a few verses at a time and trying to cover those in as thorough a way as I can. And I love what we do in our neighborhood fellowships, where we take a chunk of a chapter at a time. But the problem with that is you can only get through so much material when you're moving along at that rate. It'll be probably at least 30 messages in 1 John, and even Genesis, and 1 John is only 5 chapters, and Genesis is probably going to be close to 60 lessons for 50 chapters, so that's much faster, but it would still be a long time before we get through the whole Bible in our neighborhood fellowship notes. And so there's a benefit to spending some time going through books of the Bible where we're looking at a whole book of the Bible in one night, and we're getting a sense of the big picture, and we're looking at the structure, and you get a sense of that big picture. And so, Lord willing, at present, the plan is to pick up with Exodus on October 6th. So if you want to be preparing, we'll be doing Exodus next, and we'll go through 4th and so on through the rest of the Old Testament, and Lord willing, into the New Testament as well. Before we dig in, let's take a moment to pray. Father, I come before you and I thank you for your goodness. I thank you for your word. I pray you'd give me wisdom and I pray you'd give clarity. And I pray, Father, Lord, for your strength in the presence of your spirit. In Christ's name, amen. So we will have, this will be more of a class than a sermon. So I'll be teaching and I'll ask some questions potentially and at least have some opportunity for you all to ask questions at the end if we don't run out of time. Two notes, two resources I wanted to draw your attention to. This is an introduction to the Old Testament. I'm not going to be following it like a textbook but still, it's a book we have in the bookstore that no Old Testament introduction I'm aware of is without problems, but this one has fewer problems and more benefits than most. And so I would not agree without qualification with everything that every author in the book says. But as a whole, it's a very healthy and very helpful helpful book if you want to take the survey a little bit further. And again, you know, going one book a month instead of one book a week, it wouldn't be too hard to keep up with the chapters in it. So it'd be a resource to be aware of if you'd be interested in that. And then we got these Tyndale House Inc. magazines. They come out once a quarter, and I've been trying to get them and finally was able to do so, and we should be getting them moving forward. And it's just some helpful articles about Bible study. Again, I'm not going to promise that we'll agree, that, you know, I would or you will agree with every single article that's ever contributed, but on the whole, they're very helpful and some really interesting articles that just brief, easy articles. It's not some academic, it's academics writing, but they're writing at a non-academic way. And there's even pictures. So there you go. And they're free. So you can take one of those. We have two issues on the back for your table if you're interested in that. So before we dig, so in our neighborhood fellowships, as I mentioned this morning, we're going to be in the neighborhood fellowships this week. We're going to be doing a review of all of the credos that we've done, where we're going to work through the story of Genesis. But this, as we start our sort of overview of the Old Testament, we're going to be looking more at the structure of Genesis and some of the more introductory things. So one of the things that I'm interested in, and I hope at least some of you are interested in, is the names of the biblical books. What are the different names they've been known by? Why are they known by those names? who gave them those names, and what do they mean? All of those sorts of questions are things that you wouldn't normally take the time to cover in a sermon, even if you were preaching through Genesis. But sometimes it can be helpful to know, because hopefully at least some of you are curious about that sort of thing. And we'll touch on other things as well. So if you are totally bored by understanding the names of the books of the Bible, there'll be something for you as well that hopefully you won't be bored by. So let's move on. But before we dig into Genesis, I want to spend a few minutes talking about the Pentateuch as a whole. The Pentateuch is known, the work is known as the Pentateuch. How many of you are familiar with the name Pentateuch? Okay, how many of you are not familiar with it? Okay, so at least some of you are not familiar with it. It is from the Greek Pentateuchos, meaning a five-book work, so a work that's divided into five books. And one of the senses of the Greek word toikos is volume, and the Greek word penta means five. So Pentateuch means a five-volumed book. As we will see, the Pentateuch is a single work, each part of which has a literary structure of its own. So you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Each of those is a book in its own right, and yet they also form a book as a whole. So it's a single literary unit, all the first five books of the Bible. And there's other names that the Pentateuch is known by. The rabbis called it the five-fifths of the law. Kamisha kumshe Torah, the five-fifths of the law. And, of course, another name that some of you might be familiar with is the law, or the Torah. And this is one of the more common designations. And law comes from the Hebrew Torah. You might have heard that in what I just read. But it's important to recognize that the word Torah, while law isn't a bad translation of Torah, the idea that's encapsulated by the Hebrew word Torah is a much broader one than what we may understand by our English word law. So it certainly is law, but it's a little bit more general when we think of the laws on the statute books. It's more general than that. It may even convey the idea of instruction. So Leviticus is law, but Genesis is also law, which doesn't necessarily make sense from our perspective, but if you understand, the Hebrew word Torah encompasses everything we find in the first five books, or the books of Moses. So Genesis is Torah as well as Leviticus. Now, while we're talking about the Pentateuch is, or the Torah, is the first division of the Hebrew Bible. And one thing that some of you may be aware of is that the Hebrew Bible is divided up into different sections than typically the English Bible is. So the English Bible, the way we typically divide the books of the Bible of the Old Testament up, does anyone want to tell me the divisions of the Old Testament? Everybody jump at once. History would be one of them. Prophecy. Poetry. And we miss the easiest one. The Pentateuch, the law, right? So you got law, history. So we have the law, then we have the books of history, then we have the books of poetry, and then we end with the books of prophecy. Those are the sections, if you have an English Old Testament, that it will typically be. Actually, I'm not aware of an English Old Testament that divides it any differently than that. So those are the sections in the English Old Testament. Now, this arrangement, so that section, that order of first Pentateuch, then history, then poetry, then prophecy, that goes back ultimately to the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So it's a little bit more complicated than this, but it's often referred to as the Septuagint, or you might see the phrase LXX. How many of you have ever heard the word Septuagint? Okay, most of you. So that's the kind of singular name. There actually are lots of different Greek translations of different books of the Old Testament that were made by different people at different times. It's a very sort of complex area. But if you sort of sum up that whole big reality, talk about the Septuagint, then in the Greek Bibles that we have, the arrangement of law, history, poetry, prophecy, that comes from the Greek, and ultimately that influenced the Latin, and Latin was the dominant language when all of our modern language Bibles were first being translated, and once you start printing things in a particular order, then it confuses everyone if you mix it up. And so it sort of has this inertia that keeps on going. But the Hebrew Bible is arranged somewhat differently. So we divide it up into four basic sections. They divide it up into three basic sections. So it starts with the Torah, or the law, the same as our Bibles. So you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. They don't use those names, but those are the books, the same books, the same content, in the same order. And then after the law, you have the prophets. So you have Torah, and then you have the Nevi'im, and the prophets. And you have the former prophets, and the former prophets are Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. So you have Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And then the latter prophets, you have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the Book of the 12, which is the 12 minor prophets that are counted as a single book. Those are the latter prophets. And then the third division is called the writings, and everything else that we find in our Old Testaments is put into the writings. And actually, this is the division that would have been familiar to Jesus and the 12 apostles. In Luke 24:44, we find this, "And he," that is Jesus, "said unto them, These are the words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled, which are written in the law of Moses," it's the first five books, "and in the prophets," that's the second group of books, "and in the Psalms." The Psalms, of course, is the largest and most significant book of the writings. "And in the Psalms concerning me." And so this threefold division of the Hebrew Old Testament, of which the Torah is the beginning, is something that would have been familiar even to Jesus and the apostles. Any questions about any of that? I know we covered a lot of material very quickly. Okay, we'll move on. Yes. There's a lot of debate about that, and I don't think anyone actually knows. So that's a very interesting question. I don't know, and I don't think anyone does. I have read about it, and I know there's different opinions and theories, but to my knowledge, it's not like anyone at the time wrote down and said, "Hey, we're going to do it this way for this reason." There's been discussion over it. I'm not aware of I'm not aware that anyone knows. So. Brother Tanaka? So Brother Tanaka asked, when was the Septuagint translated and how accurate was it? So here's where it gets into the complicated bit, and that is, we say the Septuagint, and you can get this nice book that's the Septuagint. It says on the outside, it says it's the Septuagint, but actually, you know, that's the result of modern editors picking a particular translation from all of the ancient translations on offer and sort of, you know, putting that in. The key thing that happens is a few centuries before Christ, the Torah is translated. That's done by one group of people. That's done, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's done at least two centuries before Christ. And that's a reason, and then the other books start to be translated. Many of them are translated more than once. Then those translations influence one another. It really is enormously complicated. And there are many hundreds of people who have done PhDs on one tiny bit of that whole huge puzzle. But broadly speaking, by the time of Christ, most of the canonical books, if not all of them, would have been available in Greek. And in fact, in the New Testament, many of the New Testament writers make more use of the Greek Old Testament than they do of the Hebrew Old Testament. So they use both. And so you can actually see, if you're looking at it really closely, Paul, for instance, will use both the Greek and the Hebrew. And then, of course, you have to... Yeah, so I won't spend any more time on that, but it's this really fascinating puzzle that many, many people spend a lot of time figuring out, but that we probably won't cover tonight. Brother Don? Oh, I wouldn't I mean, so the Torah is the Torah, which is what we're talking about tonight. The Torah is a few hundred years before Christ. It's a lot. It's not like people like left records. I translated this book at this time, and so I'd really want to have specifically studied that. So it would differ. It would differ for each book. So you certainly have a lot of the key books, you know, before the time of Christ. You know, which particular form of which particular book and how is that assembled? I mean, you're putting together a puzzle with about 80 to 90% of the pieces missing. And so it tends to be, you know, that there's a picture there somewhere, but it can end up being a bit speculative how you put it together. So there's some things we know. We know the Old Testament's available in Greek in some form. We know the New Testament writers are making use of it. We know it's being read in Greek-speaking synagogues. So we know those things. That the law and the prophets are being read, and that it's a source of people coming to Judaism from the Gentile world. So proselytes, we know some of those things. But exactly, you know, what form of the Greek Old Testament was present at a particular place in a particular time, we just don't have that kind of data. And so it ends up being a source of debate in that case. Take one more question, then we'll move on. Pardon? Do we have the same order of books? Well, in the Pentateuch, you have the same order, but there are differences in we have Joshua, Judges, that's the same. We have Ruth. Ruth is in the writings. And then 1st and 2nd Samuel is one book in Hebrew, so Samuel. And Kings, that's the same. And then Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther are in the writings. And so even in the Hebrew, so there's a great stability. So what we find, everyone agrees, every sort of language and tradition, that the books of Moses are foundational, they come first, and they're always in exactly the same order. The prophets, so the historical books, there's some movement, so you still have the Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings order, but where to put Ruth, where to put Esther, where to put Ezra, Nehemiah, there's some variation there. And then once you get to the writings and the books of poetry, there's a massive amount of variation even within the Hebrew Bible. So people arrange them in different orders for different reasons. And again, there's a lot of interesting work that's been done on that, but we don't have time to get into all of that tonight. We'll talk a little bit more when we get to that section of the Old Testament. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And I'm actually going to follow the order of the Hebrew Bible as we go through the series. And so that's something that, you know, perhaps just, there actually are, when you, this order, I think, at least the general order of moving from the Torah to the former and the latter prophets and to the writings, there's some very interesting parallels to the structure of the New Testament canon as well. When you arrange them in that order and you can see, it's not make a massive difference or some, you know, massive new theological insight, but it is an order that's been passed down to us, and it's, you know, I think, important to discuss and does have some helpful clarity on some points. All right. Good discussion. We may not get through all the notes that I brought tonight, so we may not be getting to Exodus next week. And that will not be the end of the world at all. So let's talk about the theme of the Pentateuch. So we talked about the names of the Pentateuch and a little bit about the divisions of the Hebrew Bible more generally. Let's talk next about the theme of the Pentateuch. At the very center of the Pentateuch are the promises that God made to Abraham and to his descendants. And these promises, particularly in Genesis, they're worded in many different ways with many different particulars, but they can be accurately be summed up under the following four heads. God promised Abraham a seed. He promised him descendants. Number two, God promised that Abraham and his seed would have a covenant relationship with him. Number three, God promised that God would give the seed of Abraham the land that he promised. So he promised a seed, a covenant relationship with God, and a land. And the fourth promise, while it's not nearly as prominent in the Pentateuch, you find hints of it all throughout, through the entirety. And it is crucial for the way that these promises connect to the rest of Scripture. And that is that through the seed of Abraham, all the nations of the world will one day be blessed. So God promised that through the fulfillment of these first three promises, through giving Abraham a seed, a land, and a covenant relationship with God, that the nations would be blessed, the curse would be reversed, and Babel would be undone. And if you look at the structure of Genesis 1 through 11 and the way that this crucial transition takes place, and I won't take time to dig into the details, I've done that in other contexts, but it is very evident that God is saying, my call of Abraham is what I'm going to do to fix the dilemma of the rebellion of humanity. The theme of the Pentateuch has been aptly summed up by one scholar in a widely referenced summary that I've modified only slightly. And that is, the partial fulfillment, which implies also the partial non-fulfillment of the promise to the patriarchs of abundant descendants, a covenant relationship with God, and a land of their own. Genesis 1 to 11 lays the foundation, answering the question of how the world got to the place where God's work, which henceforth deal with the problems of the world by means of a covenant relationship with the descendants of one particular man, namely Abram. And the remainder of the Pentateuch fleshes out the promises that God made to Abram, later to be known as Abraham. The promise of descendants is emphasized in Genesis 12 through 50. So, Genesis 1 to 11 explains how that God, how the world got to the place where God's dealing with the world as a whole. So God is the one who created the world. He created all people in the world. But why is the God of the universe so focused on one particular family? Genesis 1 to 11 answers that question. And then in Genesis 12 through 50, the promise of descendants is emphasized. So there are a lot of strange stories in Genesis 12 through 50. In a couple of weeks, we'll be dealing with Genesis 34. In a few more weeks, we'll be dealing with Judah's misadventures in Genesis 38. Okay, these are really weird stories. And you wonder, why is this story about the rape of Dinah and the extermination of a Canaanite city? What is that doing in the Bible? And if you know what that's doing in the Bible, then what in the world is going on in Genesis 38 where Judah is behaving in all of these outrageous ways with Tamar and all of this messy, messy, weird stuff is going on? Why is that in the Bible? And more specifically, why is it in the book of Genesis? Well, when you understand the theme of the Pentateuch as a whole, that it's dealing successively with the promise of God to Abraham, then what you find is that Genesis 12 through 50 is basically going through a list of every possible thing that could go wrong to keep God's promise of a distinct nation coming from Abraham from being fulfilled. So you wonder, why are there so many barren women? It's like every woman that comes into the family can't have children. Well, because the serpent is at war with the seed of the woman, and therefore, these women can't have kids. And yet somehow they still produce a mighty nation. And you could think of, well, maybe the women will get kidnapped and have children for someone else. Well, they get kidnapped, but they don't have children for someone else. Maybe they'll intermarry with the nations. Maybe this will happen. Maybe this will happen. It's almost every bizarre thing you could think of happening that would keep God's promise from being fulfilled actually happens in Genesis. And yet it doesn't stop God from fulfilling his promise. Every misdeed that you could imagine, maybe God's people will mess up in this way, or this way, or this way. They do it all. And yet God still fulfills his promises to them. And so that's what you find in Genesis 12 through 50. And then in Exodus and Leviticus, the covenant relationship with God is what's emphasized. And the promise of the land is emphasized, though not yet fulfilled, in Numbers and Deuteronomy. So there's this heavy emphasis in Numbers and Deuteronomy that they are headed to the land. So you have a threefold promise, and each element of those promises is emphasized in term. And if, as we're going to talk about in a few moments, if you hold, as I think you should, to the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, then you realize that these books are addressed to people who are about to enter the land. They're about to put God's promises of a land of their own to the test, and therefore Moses tells them that God was faithful to his promise to make you a nation. He was faithful to his promise to bring you into a relationship with him, and therefore he can be trusted despite great obstacles and great failure to be faithful to his promise to bring you into the land. And that helps you to understand that sort of progression, and that is the theme of the Pentateuch as a whole. Any questions about that theme, the theme of the Pentateuch? All right. Now, in addition to the division into five books, so the Pentateuch, you know, we talked about it, it's the five-volumed book, and each of those books has a unity in its own right, but there also is an overlapping structure of the Pentateuch as a whole. This is one of the things that's really interesting to me about some of the books of the Old Testament, is that for a number of the books of the Old Testament, there are multiple interlocking and overlapping structures that each are intended, and yet which structure the... So the book of Leviticus has no less than three different structures that are interlocking and stacked one on top of the other. It's one of the most intricately crafted books in, even apart from its inspiration, you look at all of human literature, it's one of the most intricately crafted books that's ever been written. The book of Leviticus is not just boring regulations. It's one of the most carefully crafted pieces of literature that's ever been written. And when we get to Leviticus, I hope to show you a little bit of that. But the same thing that is true on the level of the individual books is also true of the Pentateuch as a whole. Now, the last time I tried this, I went through all of the precise calculations and everyone's eyes glazed over. So I'm going to skip the calculations and abbreviate what I'm about to say. Because in addition to the division into five books, the Pentateuch also has an overlapping threefold structure that cuts across the boundary lines of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Sinai experience of Israel, which begins in Exodus 19:1 and ends in Numbers 10:11 through 13, occupies almost exactly a third of the Pentateuch. So the Pentateuch is divided into five books, but it can also be divided into three parts, each of which is almost identical in length. And the part that is in exact center is there's a clear indication in Exodus. So Israel's delivered from Egypt, and they come to Mount Sinai. And there's a clear marking in the text. We're now at Mount Sinai. And they don't leave Mount Sinai until Numbers chapter 10, and there's a clear marking in the text. They're journeying away from Mount Sinai. So you have a third of the book over here, a third of the book over here, and a third of the book over here, and you don't split something into, I mean, if any of you have tried to cut something into thirds, you don't get obvious thirds by accident. You know, it's not a random sort of occurrence. You know, you might be able to cut something in half just sort of naturally, but if you want to cut an apple into three parts, I can't do it even when I try. So there is, now that isn't much of an argument, I recognize, but if you look at the structure as a whole, it's clearly intentional that this didn't happen by accident, that the center of the Pentateuch is Israel's experience at Sinai, and as we'll talk, there's even a center to that center that really is quite fascinating how it's all structured. But that sort of overarching structure of the journey to Sinai, the time at Sinai, the journey away from Sinai serves to keep the Pentateuch as a whole together as a single larger unit that is composed of these individual books. So those boundaries, they reach across and sort of lock the five books together. Is that clear? Wonderful. And that highlights the central significance of the Sinai Covenant for the message of the Pentateuch as a whole. As the authorship of the Pentateuch, so because of that interlocking structure and a number of other reasons as well, the authorship of the Pentateuch and that of Genesis is inseparable, and so we're going to consider the two together here in a moment. So we'll give a brief introduction to Genesis, and then we'll dig into the authorship question, and that really will apply to the Pentateuch as a whole, as well as to the book of Genesis. But before we move on to Genesis, any more questions about the Pentateuch? All right. As the very first book in the Bible, Genesis is foundational to all that follows, just as Revelation is conclusional to all that precedes. It is a book of beginnings, explaining the origin of the most fundamental realities of our existence as human beings. The universe exists because in the beginning God spoke and it was so. Humanity exists because God created mankind, male and female, in his image and as his likeness. Marriage exists because it was not good for Adam to be alone. Sadly, Genesis is also a book of rebellion, detailing the devastating destruction that human sinfulness brought into God's very good creation. Sin exists because Adam and Eve believed the serpent more than their creator. Human government exists to ensure that the shedding of man's blood does not go unpunished. The nations exist because God scattered the rebellious tower builders across the face of the earth. Most importantly, Genesis is a book of redemption, laying the foundation for the glorious rescue operation that is even now underway. Though we still live east of Eden, the followers of Jesus are headed back to the garden city we have been exiled from for so long. And this is just something. I was reading through the book of Ezekiel the other day, and I was reading the account of Ezekiel's temple, which if you read the end of the story of Ezekiel's temple, you'll find there's 12 gates, and there's a direct quote from Ezekiel in Revelation 21, where it's describing the city that's descending. There's 12 gates with the 12 names of the 12 tribes, and it matches exactly the two passages. But the water that heals the nations comes out towards the east. And when mankind is exiled from the Garden of Eden, they head out, the cherubs are placed at the eastern entrance to Eden. And the way to God's presence that was once blocked is now open. And when Cain is exiled, he goes east to the land of the east. So he's moving in this eastward direction away from God. And when the water comes out, it's headed to cleanse the corruption of humanity. And of course, John draws on that when he speaks about the water and the blood and how Jesus is the fountain of life. That's another connection for another story. But it was just interesting how there are all these interesting and intricate connections between Genesis and Ezekiel and Revelation that connect the whole Bible together in one story of redemption. Though we still live east of Eden, the followers of Jesus are headed back to the garden city we have been exiled from for so long. Though we still experience the curse mankind's rebellion unleashed, the resurrection power that will destroy that curse is already at work in our hearts. Though the seed of the serpent is still at war with the seed of the woman, the head of that serpent has already been crushed. Though all the families of the earth have not yet received the blessing of Abraham, we ourselves have been given the commission to proclaim the coming of the promised seed to all nations. Any questions about that? All right, let's talk about the title of Genesis. So we talked about the names of the Pentateuch, and now we're going to talk about the names by which the book of Genesis is known. So the Hebrew title is Bereshit, and that comes from Genesis 1:1. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim va'et ha'aretz. So the very first word in Genesis is Bereshit, which means in the beginning. And one of the things in the books of the Hebrew Bible, they'll typically name the book by one of the first words in the first sentence of the book. So it's a pretty straightforward way. You sort of, you know, put the first word, that's the title of the book. So Bereshit, it means in the beginning. And that's a very common pattern. This is also how passages were referred to before there were verses. So verse numbers are a relatively recent phenomenon, and before there were verse numbers, they would refer to specific passages of Scripture by one of the first key words in the passage. So that's how Jesus refers to in the passage about the bush. He sort of lists a key word from the beginning and uses that to refer back to a passage. And the idea was that you knew your Old Testament so well that when you heard like the first word of a passage, you would immediately know what passage that went to. And there's actually an interesting article in one of the Ink magazines that I showed you earlier about how Hebrew scribes used, you know, sort of referred to passages by the first word of the passage and how they used that to ensure that the text was being transmitted accurately. So the Hebrew title is Bereshit. The English title comes from the Latin, which comes from the Greek. So the Latin title is Titer. The Latin title is Liber Genesis, and the Greek title is Genesis. And this is the word that's used in various grammatical cases to translate the Hebrew word toledot, which we'll discuss in a few minutes. So we'll talk about these are the generations. Well, the Greek word that's used for the Hebrew word that's used for generations is Genesis, and that's what the Greek translators gave as a title to the book. And that's where we get our English word Genesis from. And of course, our English word Genesis actually has its meaning shaped by the content of the book of Genesis. So when we talk about the genesis of something, the ideas that come to our mind have been shaped by the fact that we've called this book Genesis, and that's how we define the word. So now it really fits well, better than it did perhaps at the beginning. So that's the title of Genesis. Any questions about any of that? Okay. Let's talk about the author of Genesis. Genesis is formally anonymous. So when you read one of Paul's letters, say you read the book of Romans, he starts out by saying, Paul, an apostle, you know, to the Romans, or Paul, an apostle to the Philippians. You don't find anything like that in Genesis or in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or Deuteronomy. But one of the reasons for that is that these are books that are coming to us from the ancient Near East. And in the ancient Near East, it was very uncommon to write down the author of a book at the beginning. It didn't mean no one knew who wrote it. It just wasn't something that was done. You know, we have all kinds of conventions for punctuation, for what goes on a title page. You know, we want to know where a book was published, all these sorts of information that has been standardized down through the millennia that now you pick up a book and you expect to find, you know, an ISBN number, for instance, if you're into that sort of thing. But if you look at the information that a book provides, we'll now find all this information. Well, that's been a development over the centuries of what sort of information is standard to include at the front of a book so you can sort of place it among other books. That's very new. That wasn't the case when the five books of Moses were put out. In fact, a noted scholar of the literature of the ancient Near East more broadly, we have many books that have come down. And he pointed out that only two works from this time period, so of the hundreds and perhaps even thousands of different works that we have, only two of them have an author named at the beginning. So if Genesis did start with, this is the book that Moses wrote about the genesis of all things, that would be suspicious, not the fact that it doesn't have a title. So sometimes you'll meet with sort of cheap skeptics that don't really know what they're talking about, that will raise all of these sorts of questions. But the problem is the assumptions that they're basing their skepticism on are very modern assumptions that may or may not have anything to do with the actual conditions in which the book was written. So something to keep in mind there. But something that's interesting is it's perhaps not accidental that all four of the Gospels are formally anonymous as well. So you have the beginning of the Old Testament, the books of Moses, there's no author listed. Well, conventions had changed somewhat, so you know, you have epistles and other books that are written with an author, but there's a certain sense in which the Gospels are parallel in terms of their foundational significance for the New Covenant, that the books of Moses are foundational for the books of the Old Covenant, and there's a striking number of similarities, including the fact that an author isn't listed, even though authors were known from early on, but then an author isn't listed in the text, that there's maybe a distinct effort being placed to put the Gospels on a par with the books of Moses. And actually, if you look at the canon as a whole, you find Genesis, which really is quite unique, and then four other books of Moses. Then you have four Gospels, and at the very end, you have Revelation. So Genesis deals with the beginning of all things, Revelation deals with the end of all things, and then at the beginning of the New Testament, you've got four books that are foundational, and at the beginning of the Old Testament, you have four books that are foundational, and there's a lot more parallels than that. And actually, you can find in this book that I mentioned, there's a beautiful chart that outlines all of this in greater detail than we'll go into tonight. The first sort of introductory chapter covers that, and it's really quite interesting. So, right, back to the authorship of the Torah and Genesis. In a strict sense, the Torah is anonymous. Nowhere do these five, this is a quotation from another book, nowhere do these five books explicitly or implicitly claim that Moses is their exclusive author. On the other hand, early Jewish and Christian tradition is virtually unanimous in ascribing Genesis through Deuteronomy to Moses. On what grounds? Well, as it turns out, there actually are very good grounds for the traditional ascription of authorship to Moses. While Moses is never referred to as the author of the whole, so there's no place that says, I, Moses, wrote Genesis through Deuteronomy. Well, those names hadn't been invented yet, so that would be surprising if you found him saying something like that. And also, there's no place like that at all. So, however, he is referred to as writing in various places in the Pentateuch. So a good portion of the material is in the text directly tied to Moses. Now, I should note at this point, in English, we typically don't refer to ourselves in the third person in modern English. So I usually don't say to my wife, well, Peter was in the office today, if I'm talking about myself. I might be talking about Peter Bradrick and, you know, something like that, or some other Peter. But she would assume if I said Peter was in the office, I was talking about someone other than myself. We don't talk about ourselves in the third person. We don't write about ourselves in the third person. But actually, in documents from the ancient Near East, even in cases where it is very clear that someone is writing about themselves, it's very common for people to write about themselves in the third person. So this is a very common thing in the ancient world. This is not unusual. This should not be a cause for suspicion that Moses had nothing to do with it because he's writing about himself. Now, I don't think Moses wrote about his own death. I think that's taking things a bit farther than we have evidence for. But the fact that Moses says Moses did this and Moses did that is not at all surprising and actually a very normal thing in the literature of the ancient Near East. So it doesn't form an obstacle to Mosaic authorship. So in a number of places throughout the Pentateuch, there are references to the Lord telling Moses to write something. And the Lord said unto Moses in Exodus 17:14, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Exodus 24:4. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and builded an altar under a hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Exodus 34. And the Lord said unto Moses, write thou these words. And in Numbers 33:2, and Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord. Deuteronomy 31, Moses therefore wrote this song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel. So we have in the Pentateuch a number of references to Moses writing down various things that form part of the Pentateuch. So he's writing laws, he's writing journeyings and goings out and the words of God. He's writing all of these things down. But we don't just have references. So, you know, you'd have to say based on the testimony of the Pentateuch itself that at least large portions of it claim to be written by Moses. So the book as a whole doesn't say at the beginning, hey, this is written by Moses, but there's big chunks like all the laws, for instance, or all the travel narratives, for instance, that claim to be written by Moses at the command of God. But later references in the Old Testament refer to a book or laws by Moses. So the law is a way to refer to the first five books, the Torah. Only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do, Joshua 1:7 through 8, according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. This book, skipping down a bit, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth. So there's a reference to the law as a book that Joshua had access to. So there's this book that's connected to Moses, it's called the law that Joshua has. And that's towards the beginning of the Old Testament narrative. We find the same thing at the end of the Old Testament narrative in the book of Ezra. And they set the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their courses for the service of God, which is at Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. So they're following instructions that they find in the book of Moses. So there's a book that's associated with Moses. References from the Old Testament could be multiplied. There also are many references in the New Testament to particular laws or institutions or passages that are found in the Pentateuch, and they're referred to as coming from Moses. Now, while none of those that I have noticed are directly connected with Genesis, the overall literary unity of the Pentateuch would argue that Genesis would also be connected with him. So the Pentateuch as a whole is a literary unit, and there are things that stretch across the books of the Pentateuch that argue whoever put the Pentateuch together was looking at it as a unit. So if one part of that unit is ascribed to Moses, then that means he had something to do with the entirety of it, or at least with the bulk of it, the overall structure of it. Matthew 8:4, "And Jesus saith unto him, See thou tell no man, but go thy way, show thyself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded for testimony unto them. John 7:19, Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keepeth the law? Acts 15:21, For Moses of old time hath in every city them that preach him, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day." Once again, references could be multiplied. So there are a lot of reasons to see the Pentateuch as going back to Moses. It's formally anonymous, but there's lots of reasons to connect it to Moses. There are a few things that sort of stand in tension against that. One of them is there are a few places, the exact number is debated. There's one in particular that's very clear, where it seems like a place name has been updated. So in Genesis 14:14, we see this. "And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan." So Dan in this context is a place name in the far north of Israel. We find the same place referred to in Joshua 19:47. And the coast of the children of Dan went out too little for them, and therefore the children of Dan went up to fight against Leshem, and took it, and smote it with the edge of the sword, and possessed it, and dwelt therein, and called Leshem Dan, after the name of Dan their father. So Dan receives the name Dan when the Danites capture it. So this doesn't pose a huge problem for Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. It just argues that at some point, someone in an authoritative position to do so updated at least this one place name. Some people would see a few more, some would see a few less. I think most scholars would agree that this is something we actually find in Scripture, that it's referred to as a place by a name, that it didn't actually have that name until after Moses was already dead. There are a few others of these, but we'll move on for now. And of course, the most famous one is the account of Moses' own death. Now, it's certainly logically possible that Moses could have written the account of his own death in Deuteronomy 34. We believe in inspiration. God could have revealed the nature of Moses' death to Moses, and Moses could have written it down and handed it off before he died. I don't think the text gives us any reason whatsoever to suppose that that's what God did. So I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it seems very unlikely. We do know that Moses entrusted the law to the priest, who were the authorized keepers of this law. And we do know that somehow it makes it all the way down to Ezra, and Ezra is a ready scribe, and there's a lot of reasons to suspect that these sorts of final, maybe updatings that took place in this place or that place, that there were authorized, there were priests and others who were inspired by God to make these various sorts of updates and additions. So quite possibly Joshua may have added, or Eleazar, Aaron's son, could have added the account of Moses' death. That's quite possible. Do we know who did it? No. But then again, we don't know anything about who wrote Samuel or Kings or much of the rest of the Old Testament. So the fact that we know that almost all of the Pentateuch goes back to Moses, and someone was inspired to make a few additions after the death of Moses, we actually still know more about the authorship of the Pentateuch than we do about most of the Old Testament. So we really shouldn't be too worried about that. So conclusion on authorship. I think what those who hold to the authority of Scripture, the language that's often used, is something called essential Mosaic authorship. And that means that whatever details one wants to differ on, and there's always going to be debate about the details, enough of the Pentateuch goes back to Moses that it is right and appropriate to refer to it as Moses' book. And with that, I am well satisfied as an answer. Essential Mosaic authorship combined with inspired canonicalizing updates. There's actually some interesting patterns at the last part of Deuteronomy that contains Moses' death has some very interesting connections to the first part of the prophets and the last part of the prophets and the first part of the writings, that there really are some fascinating connections in language, as though someone at some point put tail ends and beginnings to all the major sections of the Hebrew canon to make sure that they were all read together as one big unit. And it seems like that may have taken place in the time of Ezra. There's some suggestions, which is in the 400s BC. So there's some really fascinating things about a recognition very early on of the canonicity of the Old Testament and evidence of that that's present within the Old Testament itself, that these sort of canonical blocks were already recognized even at the very time that the canon was being completed. Any questions about any of that on the authorship? Nate? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing, so we're talking about, you know, in talking about the Pentateuch, everyone who's ever had an Old Testament canon has recognized the books of Moses. So there never has ever been any debate among those who had any canon consciousness at all, right? So those who don't accept the authority of scriptures, you know, don't accept the authority of the books of Moses either. But everyone who's ever, you know, even going back before the time of Christ, whenever there's discussion over this book or that book, so a book like Esther, for instance, was some discussion of debate and discussion for various reasons. That discussion never took place over Genesis because it was so obvious. So the books of the Apocrypha, they were not ever part of the Jewish Bible. So that's the reason why at the time of the Reformation, one of the major reasons why at the time of the Reformation that they were rejected, even though the Catholic Church continued to accept them, because even though they were part of the Greek and Latin Bibles, they were not ever part of the Hebrew Bible. And that's really the main, that's not the only reason that they're not inspired, but that is one of the main arguments that they're not inspired, that the Old Testament was entrusted to the Jews. These books weren't part of what was given to them. Therefore, they don't have the authoritative status that the books that were entrusted to them have. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Any other questions on that? Date. It's extremely hazardous to posit a date. The Mosaic composition must date to the time of Moses, though, as we'll see next week, or not next week, we'll see whenever we get to Exodus. I don't think we can be all that dogmatic about when exactly the Exodus took place. Though it's safe to say it's taking place sometime between 1500 BC and 1200 BC. So that's, you know, a pretty big range of years, but it still puts it, that's the possible range of dates that people give reasonable arguments for when the Exodus would have taken place. And also, Moses lived a really long time, so if Moses lives 120 years, it really depends on when in his life one wants to put the book of Genesis. I tend to think that the Pentateuch as a whole is addressed to the children of Israel towards the end of Moses' life. That even though he may have written certain portions earlier, that the final structure of it is addressed to the people as they're about to enter the land. But that's just my opinion. There's other opinions on that in terms of when in his life it would have written. And there's lots of opinions on what exactly the calendar years one would put his lifespan down on. And there's really no way to come to a final decision on that. the final canonical form with every update that was made, whether you see that as one or two places or maybe more places, I think that would have taken place at the time of Ezra. So, you know, when there was enormous destruction of Jewish life, then the normal process of copying would have ended when all of them went into captivity. And so the process of copying that led to the text that we have today would have restarted around the time of Ezra. And it really makes sense with what the Bible says about Ezra, how he's a ready scribe, how he's relaying the foundations for the religious life of the people of Israel, that the final form of the text, the final inspired form that has been preserved for us to this day, is going back to the time of Ezra. So it goes back to Moses, but any further inspired additions are stopping at the time of Ezra, and that the Old Testament as a whole is pretty much complete by that point. Any questions about that? Okay. Let's see. Let's do one more thing here. So setting and genre, let's talk about geographical setting. Pardon me. While we shouldn't overestimate our ability to determine precise modern correlations to the many place names mentioned in the book of Genesis, neither should we underestimate the significance of geography for our understanding of the text. So there are many place name identifications. Where is Ur of the Chaldees? Well, actually, there's a lot of debate about that, and the places are very far apart where Ur could be. Will we ever finally know? Well, there could be some archaeologists that discover something that ends all debate about it, so it's possible. Do we exactly know where Haran was? Well, it really depends on where you locate Ur of the Chaldees. And a lot of these identifications can be somewhat tenuous. But what isn't up for debate, and what's most important to remember, is that the events that take place in Scripture, and in particular the events that take place in Genesis, did not happen in Never Never Land, a land in which space and time are irrelevant, like the books of Buddhism, or in which the times and spaces are entirely fictional, like the Book of Mormon. So, I mean, there is a continent known as North America, but that's about it for the Book of Mormon. Rather, they took place in particular spaces and particular times, and they occurred to and among people who had particular cultures and customs, beliefs, and aspirations. In the end, the exact location of Haran and Ur of the Chaldees is less significant than the fact that each was a particular place. So here's the thing. It's more important that an archaeologist could dig up evidence that makes the location clear than that the location has already been made clear. For understanding the theology of the revelation that's given to us in these books, it's more important to know that they are real places that if we had enough evidence, we could locate than that we may necessarily have enough evidence to know with certainty where they actually were. Is everyone getting that? Does that make sense? Yes, no. I think I'm getting no from some. Let me try again. So what is more important is that these events took place in real space and real time. That's more important than that we ourselves know the exact time and place in which they took place. Right? They're real events that took place to real people that are historically situated. That history is God's story. That he is working out his plan of redemption, not in some sort of theological or philosophical never-never land, but he's working out his plan of redemption in real space and real time. And that means that he continues to work out his plan of redemption in the real space and real time that we inhabit. That's what matters, and that's why geography is so significant. The narratives about Abraham in the book of Genesis, really, it begins, Genesis 1 to 11 is covering the story of the whole earth, and then the stories of the patriarchs take place mostly within the Fertile Crescent, so stretching from Egypt all the way down to lower Mesopotamia. That's known as the Fertile Crescent, and that's where the stories take place. And let's stop there. Any final questions before we pray and conclude? Jared. Yes. Yes, because Koine Greek was like the English of today. And so it was a very universal language. So Hebrew was known by Jews and really, really serious proselytes. Not even all the Jews knew Hebrew. But almost everyone who had any financial dealings, who had any pretension, so everybody who wanted to be somebody began by learning Greek. And so you had, and there were Greek cities all over the world. So Paul could go and speak Greek in all of these places. And the fact that the Old Testament is available in Greek is really, really significant for understanding the story they're being asked to enter into. And so from very early on, that's very significant, yes. So there is a significance to it, and it really is part of preparing the way. Another part of preparing the way is that there was a time of considerable peace. So there had been a lot of war leading up to the time of Christ, but in the time of Christ and shortly afterwards, before the Jewish war, which decimated Palestine, the Roman Empire was in a period of great peace, and so people were able to travel with a freedom that hadn't been seen before and wasn't to be seen again for quite some time, and that enabled the gospel message to spread much more rapidly than it otherwise would have. So there's all these different things that are, you know, part of regular history. This is taking place, but all the pieces are being put in a line so that the gospel can be spread with the speed with which it actually was spread. Does that answer your question? Anyone else? Nate? It's in the 400s. So the exact, I don't have his exact, we don't know exactly when he dies, so we know some of the particular activities can be correlated with some of the, you know, some calendar years of some secular rulers that we know, but there isn't a real clear indication when he dies, so we don't have an exact endpoint for Ezra. And we don't know when he was born. So we have kind of a period of activity when we know he was active, and I don't have those exact years at the tip of my mind. But I know it's in the 400s. Anyone else? Well, let's conclude